I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Last week, Missouri Governor Mike Parson delivered his State of the State speech. He focused on familiar issues like workforce development and state infrastructure. But a tax bill he signed in June could hamstring efforts to fund the government. The state's now staring at a possible $500 million operating shortfall. Today we asked the governor about all that, and we'll find out why he's in town to honor a well-known Democrat. Then, with immigration at the forefront of American politics again, a local filmmaker looks at the impact immigrants have had since the 1980s in one western Kansas city. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Missouri Governor Mike Parson has delivered his first State of the State speech, and he focused again, as he has since he took office last June, on two main issues, workforce development and state infrastructure. Parson wants to replace Missourians, prepare Missourians for the jobs of tomorrow with $22 million he'd like to set aside to help train people at community colleges, technical schools, and colleges and universities. When it comes to infrastructure, the governor proposed borrowing $350 million to repair bridges and a $50 million cost-sharing program to assist cities and counties with serious needs. Governor Parson is here in the studio with me for his first visit to Up to Date. Governor, what a pleasure. Nice to have you here.
Steve, good to be here. Good to be on the show today.
Sorry about the Chiefs.
You're a big fan.
Oh, gosh.
We've been spending a lot of time there. Yeah, it was disappointing, but a great opportunity. I'm very optimistic about next year, and that's what we're talking about tonight. But they had a great year this year. It was great for Kansas City, the state of Missouri, to have a team like that. And I'm proud of their accomplishment. I wish they could have won that last game, though.
Oh, I do, too. You know, you're in town to attend a luncheon honoring former Kansas City Mayor Kay Barnes, who's a well-known Democrat. You're a Republican. Why are you attending?
Well, I think one thing, even when we look back a little bit of her history, what she done when she was mayor of Kansas City and some of the things she did for downtown Kansas City, and you see the benefits of that today. Regardless of politics, it's sometimes about getting things done that make things better. And I think you always have to admire people that's really stepped up and done that. So
yeah.
It'll be great to see her again today.
You bet. You've been governor for nearly 8 months now after taking over from Eric Greitens, who resigned under this cloud of scandal. I bet it's been a whirlwind for you.
You know what? It has. It was a tough transition period of time, needless to say, for the amount of time we had and everything. But, you know, again, in your opening remarks, I tried to stay focused on really try to reach out to the people across the state of Missouri. We traveled a lot trying to really listen to people from all parts of the state and really figure out what was the priorities on their mind. And what you said in the beginning, what I said in the State of the State, the two things that always come to the forefront was workforce development and infrastructure. And those are issues that are good for all areas of Missouri and all people from Missouri. So I thought if there's one thing, you know, that we could really try to focus in on, it was those two things and try to figure out how we get that accomplished.
You know, when you talk about workforce development, you're talking about preparing Missourians for the jobs of the future. Site Selection magazine just ranked Missouri like in sixth place of seven northern Midwestern states when it comes to workforce development, meaning we're not doing all that well. Why have you decided to focus on that so intently?
Yeah, because I think that's the future of Missouri. I think the next generation of Missouri to be successful, and if we really want Missouri to grow, and instead of just talking about it, we got to make changes in the way we do things on the government side of things and the way we do things on the private sector. But I think one thing important to do with the programs we're talking about, the private sector will have a huge input into the education system to really make sure that these kids understand what are the job markets out there that's 10, 15, 20 years down the road and what opportunities they have. But it takes some change. You know, the education institutions have to change somewhat too from maybe what they've traditionally always done to realize, hey, we got to start listening to employers across the state of Missouri and how do we meet those demands of the future. But I really think people are starting to come together and realize, hey, this is a huge deal for Missouri and we got to do better. And I think the other thing, Steve, that we got to do, that I have to do as governor, is I have to realize when our agencies are not very good. And the Department of Economic Development, when you compare us to those other states, all those other states have a much smaller economic development program than what Missouri does, and they have a lot better outcome. So we got to admit that, which we have, and we're doing a reorg, totally reorging the Department of Economic Development.
Which you just called for last week, right?
Which I called for last week. We signed 3 executive orders last week to make sure that process started.
This $22 million you want to spend on workforce development, what would that money be used for?
Yeah, really what you're going to be targeting, you're going to be targeting somebody at 25 years or older with a household income of $80,000 or less. And what we're really looking for is those people out there maybe in that market right now that maybe I want to say that's in that $25,000 to $35,000 bracket of income. We want to give them the skills. We kind of skill them up, you know, to where they can move up the ladder a little bit to have those better jobs that we know that demand's out there. And that could be in healthcare. It could be in IT. It could be as simply as labor, whether you're a plumber, whether you're an electrician. All of those things, and I think what we really want them to do is instead of have the option to either go back to a technical school, a trade school, some sort of skill set to help them, or to even continue to go on with college education to finish that.
You know, $22 million might sound like a lot of money. Is that as much money as we need to do what you want to do, or is it still a little short?
Well, you know, I think one, it's a heck of a start. So it's a good place to go. What we hope to be is like other states have somewhat implemented these programs and they've grown and they've become much stronger. Tennessee was a perfect example of that. They started out small and then all of a sudden they realized, hey, this thing is really working. So then they funded more. But I think it's important to also realize if you're going to start the program, we got to make sure that, hey, this program really doing what we want it to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if it does and it's very successful, then yeah, I think we could add more money to it and expand.
You know, it's not lost on me as a guy who teaches at UMKC that the state has been a little hard on higher education in recent years. That would, it seemed at least on paper, to be at odds with what you want to do. Does that need to change?
Yeah, you know what? I don't know that I agree with that anymore, Steve, because I even think on the higher education end of it, I think people are realizing what the demands are out there. I think they're hearing that loud and clear, too. So I think they're willing to change their curriculum somewhat to meet those demands. And I want to be clear, too. We're always going to need architects, doctors. We're going to need professionals with 4-year degrees. But 65 to 70% of the people in Missouri don't have degrees. That is the workforce. That's a big hunk of the workforce. So we got to figure out how do we give them the tools they need to move up. And you know, being connected with the university, more than likely some of them will continue their education and probably go back and finish things just for a number of reasons why they didn't do it when they were young. But hopefully that's the whole game plan is to try to make sure we get people engaged with that.
Missouri Governor Mike Parson is my guest. There's a story, a related story in the Star this morning, Governor, about the economic border war that rages between Missouri and Kansas. It has for so many years. More than $300 million has been spent by both states the past few years to entice local companies to hop across the state line. Both states now have new governors just in recent months. What's going to happen to end the border war? Are you confident? Are you optimistic that it will end?
Yeah, I think we got to do something about that. I think we're to spend that kind of taxpayer money on both sides, whether you're in Kansas, Missouri, and you're really just walking people across the street for better terms. You're really not creating any more new jobs in the area. That's not what we want to do. We don't want to have incentive programs for that. So my plan is to meet with the Kansas governor. We're going to sit down. We're in the process of making that meeting, to set that meeting up right now. I want to sit down with her, talk to her to see what her thoughts are. But this is something we got to work out. This is not good for either state to be doing it this way. And I think that money could be used a lot more efficient in a lot of different areas.
There's another story in the paper today that says the House budget chairman is now saying the state has at least a $500 million operating shortfall. Is that due to the income tax cut that you signed last year? What's going on out there?
Yeah, I think there's several things. You got the income tax that's in there. You got some other things that go into that. But I really think that's going to get better. I think that, you know, the budget changes so much month by month, but I think really we're on track.
As the checks come in,
some months are better, some are worse. Right now, I think we're on track to where we should be, what our estimates were. So, but, you know, we're going to be keeping an eye on that like everybody else. But I don't need to think there's any reason to sound alarm button here that we're short $500 million, because I don't think we are.
You know, last summer in one of your first acts, you signed a tax cut bill, which, if revenues allow it, will shave a big chunk off the income tax in Missouri. Democrats say the result of tax cuts is the state bouncing from one crisis to another, and there might be some truth in that. The state has a lot of needs, as you know, and here are Republicans cutting taxes again. Is it too much?
Well, I think you got to be careful how you do that. I don't think you can just go out there and just totally overhaul that system right off the bat, because we're so reliant on income taxes in the state of Missouri. But I think what we're doing with the small pieces that we're doing right now is workable. I think we're seeing that right now. You know, the federal level with some of the changes they're making, I think it's going to be good for Missourians. So I think right now to making those changes is the thing to do right now. But I think you also got to be careful about it. You know, how we do that and how we go about it.
And we've done some things differently here than Kansas did. You're obviously close to the state line here.
Right.
A lot of sensitivity in this part of Missouri about what happened just to the west.
Yeah, that's exactly. And we don't want to necessarily go down the same problems. You know, what we all should be doing is whether they're good or bad ideas, sometimes you need to focus on, hey, what was the outcome of that? Was it really worthwhile to do that, or how can we do it better? So yeah. I think we're always focused on it. That's always on our mind, how we do this, how we implement these programs, these tax cuts.
You know, ultimately, I'm wondering, does Missouri have enough money in state government to do what needs to be done right now? I mean, you read the papers these days about the needs of transportation, prisons, social services. You know the list way better than I do. Do you have enough money to do what you have to do?
You know, I think we do, Steve. I think Missouri, for the most part, is a very conservative state that we try to keep those values up front, you know, of how we do the budget. Just like we try to keep in mind, how does everyday people have to operate? And I think we want government to somewhat do that. But we got to be much more efficient. As I've learned from being governor in a short period I am, I'm learning every day that we've got these programs out here that maybe are a duplicate of another agency or another department. And some of them are 6 and 7 times the duplication. That's the kind of stuff we need to clean up. You know, you can look in the Medicaid arena or the mental health side of it. And the mental health side is very dear to me because it's something from being in law enforcement I just think we got to do a better job of in the state of Missouri. But we also got to streamline that to make sure the people that really need the help are getting the help. Mm-hmm. We just get too many people that siphon off of those programs because they're so big that we sometimes lose control over that. And I think both of those agencies, as big as they are, we have to really take a look at how to streamline that and really get the people that need it. And that's what we all should be focused on.
You know, there's this ongoing debate in Missouri and so many other states about the type of state we should be to attract more business here. Is it the low tax structure that's most appealing to businesses, or is it a state that offers amenities like a robust highway system that's well-paved and well-run? Where do you fall on that right now?
Well, you know, Steve, one, I think you got to have the infrastructure in place. There's no doubt about that. When businesses come here, they want to know how they can get their products in and out of the state and how they can get it shipped out to the world anymore. It's just not the small shops anymore. You got to, when businesses come to town. So the infrastructure is a huge piece. Broadband's a huge piece. I mean, when you think, one of the things that I was sad
we
to
take
hear,
it for granted here in the cities, but out in the countryside,
yeah,
it's a big issue.
Yeah, I was saddened when I became governor and didn't realize, but we still got like 8 schools in the state of Missouri that don't have broadband.
Wow.
You know, I mean, how do you give a kid the opportunity to even succeed in today's times with that, or whole communities that don't have broadband? But infrastructure is a huge piece to that. And for the businesses, when they look at Missouri, we got to figure out, we compete against everybody else. And that's just the truth. So you got to be competitive. I mean, with Kansas, with Nebraska, with Indiana, with similar states all around us, we got to figure out how do you draw those businesses here. But we got a lot to offer. We need to do a little better job of marketing who we are. I would say that, you know, that we don't do a good enough job about that. But there's a lot of things we can do.
What's the most appealing thing for leaders of big businesses? Is it the low taxes, or is it a state with amenities? What do you see?
Yeah, you know, one thing I think when you talk to businesses, when you talk to like a new core that come into Sedalia Steel Plant, or you look at Boeing, for example, the big contract they had with the TX program, you know, one of the things these companies are looking at is that workforce. I mean, that's a number one priority. They're going to look at workforce. They're going to look at utilities.
Are their workers trained and qualified to
do
what they
them?
Have to do?
And do you have the availability to do it? You know, if they start looking at you and say, well, you guys are really not doing anything in this area, why do we think you are going to expand that? I think we got to show them. That's why this workforce development piece, I think, is just crucial for the state of Missouri to draw businesses here. But I'll even make it one step forward, Steve. It's not about bringing business here. It's about taking care of the ones you got in the state also. Because, I mean, you look everywhere you go, they're looking for good quality people. But I'm optimistic because that's opportunity, too, for all of us to come together and figure out solutions.
Again, Governor Mike Parson is my guest. You've also focused heavily, as you've mentioned, on infrastructure since you took over. You campaigned to pass the 10-cent a gallon gas increase, but it obviously failed at the polls in November. Now you're talking about borrowing $350 million to fix up bridges across the state. Why do you want to borrow the money to get that done?
Well, I think that money, because because it's long-term investments, number one. I think, you know, we took a good serious look at that, and we took a business approach to that, and we said, okay, if we're going to go down the bonding route of borrowing this money, what are we really going to borrow on? So the bondings themselves are 15-year at $30 million a year. The point of it is we're bonding things that have a lifespan of over 50 years. Mm-hmm. If there ever was a time to bond, those are the type of things you bond. The rates are good right now, and I think it's a good time to lock those in. But the reality of it is the people says, hey, we don't want to pay any more taxes for this. We don't want to do it. And that was just the way the polls work sometimes.
Right.
But I also think that puts the burden back on our shoulders somewhat, me as a governor, the other leaders at the Capitol, to say, okay, what solutions do we have? The problem still exists, and we got to fix it. And that's something that I thought was a reasonable thing to do. And it really would accomplish quite a bit for the state of Missouri.
I mean, I'm on the STARS editorial board, as you know, and we just called for you to give a tax gas increase another shot here. We thought the language of the November ballot was a little confusing. People didn't know what they were voting on. They thought it was going to the highway patrol, when in fact it was really intended to be more concrete for highways. A lot of confused voters out there. Are you willing to go there again?
You know, I don't think that's something I want to look at right now. I don't know what the future is going to bring, what the legislators want to do. But for me, I think that the solution we have on the table right now is probably a doable solution to help a lot. And if we can do this $350 million projects, that's 250 bridges across the state of Missouri, all over the state of Missouri. But the important thing about that for other regions of the state, most of that will probably be in rural Missouri, to be right honest about it. But that also frees up $350 million worth of new projects in the STIP program that are currently there. So they move up.
In the MoDOT program.
In the MoDOT program. And then you bring another $350 million into the MoDOT program. So that's almost $1 billion worth of infrastructure we're talking about that would be in the next 5 years. So to pull that off, if we could get that done, it's just a great way to kickstart, I think, the infrastructure projects of that. And it would be a win-win for the state of Missouri. It doesn't fix things forever. It doesn't. It's a patch is all I can say to it. But I think it's a practical thing to do right now.
What's the temperature in the General Assembly about borrowing $350 million for bridges?
Well, you know what? We have to work with them. You know, one of the things that that I plan on doing is going, meeting them one-on-one, trying to explain why I'm doing the reasons I am and why I think it's a good plan for the state of Missouri. So my job is to go out there and try to convince them of that and try to work with them. If somebody has a better idea, a better solution, believe me, I'm open to that. But the thing about it is, Steve, you just can't keep kicking this can down the road. I mean, the problem exists. You know, I mean, the bridges we're talking about fixing are not rails and putting on a pretty skirt on the outside of it. Well, what this is talking about doing is actually replacing bridges that are totally need to be totally replaced or in drastic need of repair.
You know, I've written this so many times, I have the stats burned in my mind. Missouri has the 49th lowest gas tax in the country at 17 cents a gallon, Governor. You know that very well.
Right, right.
And we have the 7th largest road network in the entire country. I mean, those two things are at odds with each other.
Right. You know, and the other thing, like I said, you know, it's water under the bridge now. It didn't pass in November, so we got to find a solution. This is a solution for the time being of how we might be able to move infrastructure in this state forward. But I think to be able to show what we talked about earlier with workforce development and infrastructure, that's a message to the rest of the world and to the rest of the United States that Missouri is willing to make changes to draw business, to maintain the businesses we have, and really to compete in the job market and be serious about it.
There's a little concern that's been expressed here locally that none of the bridges you're looking at are in Kansas City proper. You mentioned most of them are in rural Missouri.
Right.
I know these bridges have been vetted. They've been through the MoDOT review process, but there is some concern here that Kansas City is being left out.
Yeah. Well, I know that's the first thing you look at, but the reality of it, they're not, because what we did is we took projects that are $8 million and less. Is what we did. But the bottom line is another $350 million of projects. So if Kansas City had something on the STIP plan, that all of a sudden just excelled.
Okay.
So they're now going to get those projects done in the next 5 years. Plus, you're going to be bringing another $350 million into the bottom of that STIP plan. So really, you're expediting. So what it is, you've just got the big number of projects in Kansas City that you can draw federal dollars down to. The bridges we're talking about that I took out, there's no matching money to them. Those are things we just got to pay for.
Okay.
So we knew that all along, how that was going to look on the map, but at the end of it, hopefully we can kind of let everybody know that, hey, look, if you listen to the plan, Kansas City, St. Louis, the urban areas are going to be just fine, because your projects are all going to move up the list.
You know, a couple of other issues before you go. A key death penalty case is going before the state Supreme Court this week, which raises a question. You know, is it time for Missouri to move away from capital punishment, given the history of innocent people sitting on death row? I know you're a former sheriff, but I'm wondering, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I've always been supportive of the death penalty in the states. I've never changed my mind on that. The one thing I do want to do is make sure we take every resource we have to make sure we're right with the things that we have in place, whether that be DNA, you know, whatever the testing procedures are. We want to make sure we get those cases right. We all do. There's nobody wants that. But I still believe in the death penalty and the cases that need to, that are warranted for that.
You also oppose Medicaid expansion, even though a lot of Republican states, including some pretty conservative ones, have gone the other way on that issue. Why is that expansion such bad policy in your view, which could wind up providing health care for so many thousands of Missourians?
Yeah, I don't know about the bad policy side of it, but the problem is you got to fix the system we have now. And that's important, Steve. I mean, to put another whole end of bureaucracy on something that's not efficient now, I mean, you're just asking for trouble. And even other states that have expanded it are starting to feel that too, because they didn't fix it where it should be the first time. And I'll go back to what I said originally. I think if you can fix the Medicaid system that we have in place today, if we can truly reform it, which we're going to try to do that with all everything I can, I'm going to try to make sure we get that done. And then you see what the options are on the table. But for right now, we got to fix what we got.
So we fix it, and if we do that, you might be open to expansion later on?
Well, I think we would look at that on the table later on. But right now, we're spending one out of every $3 on Medicaid.
Discretionary dollars, I know.
Yeah, I mean, so you're talking, you know, a third of what all we take in. So we got to figure out how we're doing it. Again, what we should all focus on is how are we spending this money, and how are we? What is the outcome of it? Is the people that really need it are the ones getting it, and how many other people are in the system that maybe don't need to be in the system, and maybe there's some other way to take them out of the system, or are we really efficient in the bureaucracy side of it? And that's kind of where I come in as a governor to get people in place to make sure we fix that. Because I just firmly believe you're going to see lots of changes in Medicaid in the next couple of years. I think by putting Todd Richardson in as a director.
You're taking my next question. You put the former Speaker of the House as head of Medicaid in Missouri, a widely respected former speaker, by the way.
Yeah, you know what? Let me tell you just briefly why I picked him. He could have went and done about anything he wanted to do. He's a bright young man. Mm-hmm. He had plenty of offers probably to make lots of money. But one of the things that he said when he came in and interviewed for this position, which I didn't even have any idea he was coming to interview about it, he basically said he felt like he failed because he didn't do enough to reform Medicaid in the state of Missouri. And he wanted to get that accomplished where he could designate his time to it. When people really have when their heart's in the right place to do a good job, you know, that means something to me. It's just not about paycheck. It's not about a title. It's about, hey, I really want to help people. And I think that's what Todd brought to the table. And that's why finally we've got a director in place. So I hope if everybody be patient here for a year or two, let us see where we head with it. And okay, we'll ask this question again.
Okay. That's Missouri Governor Mike Parson. Governor, appreciate you coming by to visit with us.
Good to be here
very
today,
much.
Steve. Thank you.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about a new documentary that's taking a hard look at Garden City, Kansas, which has attracted thousands of migrant workers from war-torn nations in recent years. How well is that working? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, Cliff Illig, co-founder of Cerner, talked about what life has in store for him now that he's retired from the company. You can hear that and other conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Oscar nominations are out, including one for a Lawrence, Kansas screenwriter. Our film critics offer their thoughts on the nominees and the snubs. Plus, they'll let you know which movies you should see in area theaters right now. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, in 1980, the world's largest beef packing plant opened near Garden City, Kansas, attracting thousands of migrant workers from war-torn countries. That influx dramatically changed the town. How has it adapted? How did locals adjust to these waves of foreign-born residents moving into town? A new documentary, Strangers in Town, looks at that very subject, and Lawrence filmmaker Stephen Lerner joins us now. Steve, good to have you. Welcome.
Good to be here.
You say this is a film about people coming together. You know, given the focus on Garden City out in far western Kansas, that might surprise some folks.
I think it would be seen as quite an unusual thing.
Yeah. Why did it happen? Why did it work so well out there?
That's the question we kept looking for, and nobody has the perfect answer.
Yeah.
But one thing that's clear is that there was a group of people, both in the city government, the law enforcement community, the schools, the religious community, that made an explicit decision to make this work in their town.
Everybody bought in, and the religious community you mentioned played a pretty big role in that, based on what you write, say in the documentary.
Yeah, they played a big role, but so did civic leaders and private citizens. It's not to say that there weren't those who were against the changes. It's not to say that Garden City doesn't have racism and other kinds of problems, but there was a very explicit decision that we are going to make this work and we're going to thrive with the immigrants coming in.
You wonder what was at the heart of that decision. I mean, was there a sense that they knew these changes were inevitable, that the world was changing and they were going to roll with it, or was there some other reason?
Well, one reason was the beef plant that you mentioned. Unemployment was very low in Garden City in 1980, and suddenly this huge plant opened up, and they needed thousands of workers.
Oh, that's
so there was a correspondence of economic value to have these newcomers come in, as well as the more altruistic, forward-thinking, progressive folks that wanted to make it work.
Well, that helps, doesn't it? There's a business need behind it.
Yeah.
That makes a difference. Where did the idea for this documentary come from, Steve?
Well, the idea occurred to me because of how incredibly polarized the national conversation on immigration became. My partner, Ruben Aronson, who was my best childhood friend, he's an L.A. documentary filmmaker, he and I decided to make this film because we thought perhaps in a surprising way what they've done in Garden City could inform the national dialogue. After all, here's a conservative part of Kansas, right-leaning town, that has totally embraced the notion of diversity and immigration, again, with some undercurrents of protest. But from the civic leaders on down, they said, we're going to make this work.
So maybe the thinking is, if it can work out in Garden City, Kansas, it could work maybe almost anywhere, right?
Why not?
Yeah. That population out there is what, 25, 26,000 people?
It's about 26, 27,000, yeah.
I mean, that sounds tiny to us here in Kansas City, but for folks out west, that's a pretty good-sized community, right?
Not only a good-sized community, but a thriving community. Huge amount of economic development. The beef plant is not the only major employer. There's a billion-dollar milk industry there. There's a huge wind industry there, a big staging area for wind turbines. And then all the other related agricultural industries that are there. Before the beef plant was built, it was a town of about 14,000, from my understanding.
So the town is growing, it sounds like,
yeah.
Which again is contrary to the view of rural Kansas these days, so many towns suffering and declining in population, you know. You say here that Garden City has been a crossroads between cultures for a long time. Why is that?
Well, Garden City, interestingly enough, sits on the river there, the Arkansas River.
I didn't realize this history till I watched it in your film.
Yeah, and we found out when we were there that that river right at the south edge of town was the border, international border between the United States and Mexico. Now, that was before the town was there, but it was a crossing place right there by
the town. Back in the 1800s.
Yeah, and even before for Native American
people. The Arkansas River you're talking about. Yeah.
Yes, and so in fact, we were fortunate the first time we were out there filming, for one reason or another, there was water in the river there for the first time in more than a decade. So half the town was out there swimming in the river.
What were some of the assimilation problems that you've mentioned? What kinds of things happened on the dark side when it came to Garden City's recent history?
Well, in the recent history, the darkest moment was the terrorist bombing plot that would have happened in October of 16. They planned to blow up an apartment complex the day after the election, and the FBI got onto this because one of the members of the plotting group called the FBI because although they were in agreement with the racist ideology of the group, they did not want to go along with the violence. Hmm. So they became an informant.
How did Garden City, and you have some reaction in the film, but how did people react to that? Because it struck me in the film, it was almost an affront. It was an affront to people when they learned about this plot.
Yeah, the town really came together. And this the target of the attack was going to be the Somali community, a Muslim community in an apartment complex. And the town really rallied to them. There were demonstrations all over the town, students, congregations, everybody was down there. Even the leaders of the beef plant, everybody was there rallying to support those Somali folks. And ever since then, there's been a more connected feeling with that community.
Why did those folks target Garden City, the plotters?
It's a good question. They weren't from Garden City.
Right.
I think they did because they express that part of our culture that's so afraid of the demographic change that's happening here. And they targeted the darkest skin, most recent Muslim group of immigrants in the town, which is not the majority of the immigration in the town, but it's a significant group. And so I think they picked Garden City because Garden City embraces it.
What other dark things happened?
Well, there was nothing as dark as that. There were bumps along the road. I sometimes liken it to, a young couple decides to have a baby, and they may have read all the books, but they're never prepared for the advent of the baby and the changes that comes with it.
Right.
The town decided to agree with the development of the beef plant, and they thought they had some ideas of what was going to happen, but they could never fully be prepared for the impact of so many new folks coming in. Just linguistically, even today, there are 24 languages spoken in the high school.
I was just going to say, 24 languages spoken at Garden City High School. How do they make that work? That strikes me as, to say the least, a challenge for a rural Kansas community.
It was a huge challenge, and initially they didn't know how to make it work. So in the early days, they might put 50 or 60 kids from different cultures and different language backgrounds in one huge classroom and have one teacher in there who didn't speak any of those languages. And so it was pretty desperate in those days, but kids learn languages pretty fast. They probably learn more from their peer group. More recently, they've developed much more facility in terms of obtaining translators. They're very, very good teaching language. Instructions from the schools come home to kids in all kinds of different languages, depending on their backgrounds. So they've worked very, very hard. And that high school out there is one of the most magnificent schools I've ever seen.
Because?
It's just an amazing, large, modern facility. The town voted to approve a bond issue at a very bad economic time in about 2008 or 9.
Wow.
Again, a conservative area that went overboard in funding educational development. And it is a magnificent school, very progressive, forward-thinking school. And the kids seem to really like that school.
Yeah. You made a point in the film. Again, the film is Strangers in Town. And I should point out that a free public screening of the film will be at noon Tuesday at the Johnson County Community College Collaboration Center out in Johnson County, noon on Tuesday, for a free screening of the film Strangers in Town. You also made a point here to say the news media played a role in this assimilation process, even going as far as to dispel rumors at times, like, hey, folks, the rumors in town were dogs and cats are disappearing because some of the immigrants were eating them, and the media would step in and say, hey, whoa, yeah, that's going too far.
Yeah, the editors of the Garden City Telegram,
yeah.
The first one was Fred Brooks, and another one who now lives in Kansas City, Jim Bloom, were very forward-thinking, and they tended to publish articles that would dispel some of these myths that were coming around the town. And they also would do things like be very balanced in the way they reported crime statistics and other things to kind of get away from the fear-mongering that the newcomers are causing huge amounts of crime. The evidence doesn't support that. Doesn't support it today.
So again, another example of city leaders coming together to say, we're going to make this work, and because this is what our future is all about.
Right.
You know, there are lots of private businesses in Garden City that the immigrants have brought that a former mayor described as a strong part of the community. Tell us about some of those businesses that dot the downtown area now.
Well, you've got many, many restaurants, delicious foods from all over the world. You have an African shop. run by
Somalis.
Garden
City, Kansas.
In Garden City, Kansas, where you can buy products made in Africa. Mm-hmm. There are Vietnamese stores. There are so many good restaurants. And you have a market, for example, called El Remedio Market by a local businessman who also started a bus company. And there's direct bus service from Garden City to Mexico.
No kidding. And that's working?
It's working well, yeah.
These businesses, are they coming and going, or are they managing to hang on?
Many of them seem to hang on for quite a while.
That's interesting. Tell us about some of the people you feature in this documentary, because there are a bunch of them, Steve.
Well, one of the great pleasures of doing this film was to meet some of the folks who live out there. One of the most wonderful folks was Amy Longa, who directed the International Rescue Committee office that was there when we filmed. It has since closed because under the current administration, the flow of refugees has declined so much they couldn't justify having that office. She still lives in Garden City. She grew up in Uganda and just is a marvelous person and was a refugee herself. Mm-hmm. So she was adept at helping newcomers into town.
There's another young man you featured in the film, and his story just gripped me. It's a young man who had come from El Salvador.
Fernando.
Yeah, and he had left because he was in danger there. In fact, he was sitting on stage. You film him talking with some of his friends, and he starts to share his story. And he tells this very graphic story about being somewhere one day, sitting next to his good friend, talking to him, and then within an instant, a bullet kills his friend right next to him, and Fernando is able to survive. And what grabbed me here is, you know, he came to Garden City, thrilled to be there, finally living in a place where he could be at peace. And then you point out that he had been forced to go back to El Salvador because of administration policies.
Yeah, threats of violence were no longer, as of 2018, they were no longer considered grounds for asylum. He was threatened that he would be killed if he didn't join the gang that killed his best friend.
Yes, yes.
And so he fled at the age of 14, made his way up through Mexico, somehow was going across the Rio Grande in a rubber raft with some other folks. The raft sprung a leak. Everybody fell in the water. He didn't know how to swim. Somehow he got to the other side. He walks through the desert for a few days, gets picked up by immigration authorities, and because he was only 14, he was sent to a residence for young children, and then found that he could get to Garden City where his mom actually lived. Hmm. He wasn't raised by his mother. He was raised by his grandmother. So it's quite a story.
What was painful about it is, as you watch the documentary, he clearly seemed so comfortable being where he was. And then to throw in the notion that he was being forced to leave, it just hurt even watching the few minutes you have of him in the film.
Yeah. And you know, he had never told that story to his classmates. That we happened to be there filming, and somebody said, Fernando should tell his story.
Yes. Yes.
And we said to him, are you okay doing this? And he said, I'd like to.
No kidding. There's another high school student you film. I thought this was interesting, Steve. She described the city as more like a salad than a smoothie. I mean, you know, people, you know, do exist. They don't always blend together smoothly. What did you make of that?
It's very interesting.
Yeah, it was a very interesting analogy, yeah.
It also cracked everybody up in the room when she said
did.
That.
Yeah.
It's not clear exactly what she meant, but what was interesting to me is that anthropologists often use that terminology, that we're like a salad when we have a very diverse population. We work together. We're all in the bowl together. We can be tossed together. But at the end of the day, we separate, and the tomato's the tomato, and the cucumber's the cucumber.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what she meant, because some people would think that being a smoothie might be sort of like the colorblind society that some people might strive for,
right,
but is really not achievable. because we're always going to have our differences. It's not clear exactly what she meant.
Yeah,
I wish I had asked her.
That she wasn't quite, she didn't think that Garden City was quite where it needed to be yet, but it was going the right direction. That was sort of my takeaway.
Me too.
Yeah.
And yet I don't know if she really wants to become part of a smoothie.
So what do you hope this documentary does, Steve? What's your hope for it?
My hope for it, and it's a passionate hope, my hope is that people will think more about this immigration issue in a way that can break down some of the stereotypes and some of the polarities. My friend Ruben and I, Ruben's a brilliant filmmaker, we were sitting in Garden City, and it suddenly hit me that we should dedicate the film to our mothers. My mom is the daughter of Russian immigrants, Russian Jewish immigrants. His mother was the granddaughter of Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe. And so we dedicate the film to them. I hope it will help people remember that most of us, except if we're Native Americans, came from some other place.
Yeah. That's Stephen Lerner, filmmaker, lives in Lawrence. The film titled Strangers in Town. The documentary will be shown at noon Tuesday at the Johnson County Community College Collaboration Center. It's a free screening. Stephen, thanks for coming in and sharing your story.
Pleasure.
I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list.
Blue skies smiling at me, nothing but blue skies do I see. Blue birds singing a song, nothing but blue birds all day long.
That's Ella. That's Brian McTavish wearing a bright red Kansas City Chiefs sweater even a week later from the debacle here in town, with a great weekend to-do list coming up. And we can listen to Ella anytime. That's just great.
It's just too
blue
bad.
Blue skies.
Well,
it is too bad, isn't it?
It's too bad.
Governor Parson's still reeling, too. He was here earlier today, and we were talking before the show. He's a huge Chiefs fan. He didn't like what happened.
Well, no bigger than me.
Yeah, probably not. Probably
no.
True.
But anyway, the red Chiefs thing didn't work out. Well, how about some blue skies for
some blue skies?
Our boys in blue, our Kansas City Royals,
we're turning the page here, aren't we?
New chapter
in Kansas City's life. We're going to go on and look at the Royals.
Yeah, we're
Danny Duffy said on the TV the other day that the team is as good as a 2014 team that went to the World Series for the first time.
Yeah, so this is it.
Next year,
the Chiefs will take care of business. But maybe the Royals,
maybe it's this year they'll take care of business.
Maybe it is. We'll see. Royals Fan Fest this weekend, 2 to 9 Friday, 11 to 7 Saturday, downtown at the KC Convention Center.
I wish Ella Fitzgerald could be there.
Wish she could be there.
Yeah.
I mean, just
in spirit.
Yeah, well, there you go. Well, sure. Hey, why don't they play this at the stadium at Kauffman?
That is a really good idea.
That's actually too good to share for free.
Yes, that's retroactively true.
That could have been a consultation fee involved in that. Anyway.
Well, if one comes, I'm going to give you the
all
check.
All right. Yeah, okay. Royals Fan Fest. Fans and Royals players will hobnob in anticipation of the 2019 Major League Baseball season. There'll be talks and autographs and more than 40 current and former Royals players. But hey, here's the thing. If you're looking for just one true blue reason to go to Royals Fan Fest this weekend downtown, here it is. Go at 3:30 Friday afternoon. The great Bo Jackson.
Oh, wow. Wow.
The former.
I heard he was going to be. Maybe he'll break a bat over his knee for us.
Oh, well, he's there to talk about his baseball career at 3:30 Friday at Royals Fan Fest and to promote his brand new bat breaking bobblehead for Royals charities. You better believe Bo still knows. But final thought on this.
Yes.
Hey, look, spring training just, two or three weeks away?
Yep.
So right now, no other team in Major League Baseball has more wins this year than the Royals. So,
let's go with that.
So go with that and have a great time at Royals Fan Fest.
Let's go to China.
Yeah.
Why not?
That's a good idea. I got a couple of China-related things here. First off, we have the Shenyun Performing Arts Troupe. Classical Chinese dance, 7:30 Friday night, 1:30 and 7:30 Saturday, 1:30 Sunday at the Kaufman Center for the Performing Arts.
Wow.
You know, you might think the classical Chinese dance was influenced by acrobatics. But let me tell you this. It's actually the acrobatics that were influenced by the Chinese dance. Over hundreds and thousands of years.
I did not know this.
Gymnasts and eventually our modern day ice skaters, well, they're getting it from the acrobats who got it from the Chinese dancers. In a way, you're reliving in a single evening 5,000 years of Chinese civilization. And that is all weekend at Kaufman. And then we have the Chinese New Year Festival, where you'll also get plenty of Chinese dance music and lots of art from that fantastic art collection at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. It's the Year of the Pig. They're celebrating at 10 to 4 Sunday. Lots of Chinese-related activities.
Okay, be sure to see Brian's seven things to do in Kansas City this weekend at kcur.org. Yikes, what's that? Ouch.
Okay, ouch-a-rama. Yeah, okay, so here we go. It's Panic Fest. Have you heard or
Did
been
you really
to...
say ouch-a-rama?
You just repeated me, so it's officially okay to say on your show. Okay, so
you really said that, didn't you?
No, maybe not. Yeah. Okay, so you and me, we're going to lock arms or bloody stumps, and we're going to scream and scream again at this annual horror film festival known as Panic Fest. Mm. This is good. It kicks off this weekend. It goes till next Thursday. You know, just show up there anytime between now and next Thursday, and you should be fine at the Screamland Armor, North Kansas City. Actually, tonight is the preview night. You'll get to see horror science fiction thrillers like Never Hike Alone, which is an excellent idea, and Sadistic Intentions, if you say so, and The Horror Virgin, don't look at me that way, and tonight, no, not tonight, Saturday at 9:30, aficionados of the Friday the 13th film franchise won't be able to resist going to a live script reading of Friday the 13th 8, Jason Takes Manhattan. I say let him have Manhattan.
All right.
Puff the magic dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Hanalei. Little Jackie Paper loved that rascal Puff and brought him strings and sealing wax and other fancy stuff.
It's all saying.
Puff the Magic Dragon. Oh, what a great one.
And we're listening to Puff because why?
Oh, shedding a tear for Puff. Well, I don't know if you can pretend to be Puff.
I haven't heard that song in a while. What a great song.
We need to go home and hear the whole thing.
Yes, we do.
Okay,
yes.
So anyway, it's Dungeons and, ready for it, Dragons. Mm. Get it? Aha. Mm-hmm. Dungeons and Dragons meet up. You can be a hero and have a beer. Actually, that might help to be a hero with a beer while playing the world's most famous tabletop role-playing game, Dungeons & Dragons. It's a local meetup group. They love new people. Get there a half an hour early, 10 or 10:30 before the 11 to 4 action on Saturday at Pawn and Pint at 613 Walnut Street. They love new people, but you got to get there early to learn. $5 and you can become Puff the Magic Dragon, I guess.
And finally today... Pink Floyd, tell me about him.
Okay.
That's Pink Floyd. I recognize him anywhere.
Well, we're not going to get Pink Floyd at 8 o'clock Friday at the Uptown Theater.
But we're going to get something close.
But we're going to get El Monstero, or say it any way you want to. It's the St. Louis-based Pink Floyd tribute band. It's celebrating 20 years of feeling, say it with me, comfortably numb.
Yeah.
And they put on a good show. Have a great time this week.
That's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thank you, sir.
I dig that Floyd guitar.
You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date, follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, former Congressman Kevin Yoder will be here to talk about his time in Congress and whether he has any future political plans. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.